From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I walk into a room and I'm like, I want to make a film. It's about my Chinese grandmother. I want to make it as an American film, American financed, American perspective. But the entire cast is Chinese, Chinese-American. And this was before Crazy Rich Asians.
Major point, yeah.
Right, exactly.
When filmmaker Lulu Wang set out to make a personal movie, largely set in China, mostly in Mandarin, she had a clear pitch, but buyers weren't biting. She tells us about the circuitous route to making The Farewell, which went from public radio to Sundance success to indie hit of the summer. Wang also explains why she felt so strongly that her film had to play in theaters rather than finding a home on a streaming service. But first on the news banter, leadership training. Is that bull? Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, the Hobbs to my Shaw, or Shaw to my Hobbs. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, the television critics are gathered in Beverly Hills, as they do this time of year, where the networks come and present panels on their shows. And in the best of times, the people who run the networks come and speak. And the broadcast networks are now starting their run. And CBS kicked it off. And, you know, Kelly Call, he is a holdover, I'm sure he wouldn't want me to say this too loud, from the Les Moonves regime. He presented. He clearly was prepared for some blowback on a couple of issues. You know, CBS is always dogged by issues around the treatment of people of color and diversity issues and sexism. And I mean, he talked about how they have what they call unconscious bias training vis-a-vis the racial alleged bias, which involves, I think there are reality shows, which I don't watch, so I can't even address how real that is, but apparently it was an issue at the Television Critics Association tour. The thing that came up again, too, was this show Bull, and reporters wanted to ask him, maybe again, why Michael Weatherly, the star and executive producer, after being accused of misconduct on set by actress Eliza Dushku, why she left the show with an undisclosed settlement and he stuck around. And Kelly Call said something that hit me. He basically said the show does very well. More than 10 million people watch every week. Michael is loved by our audience. Even after the allegations came out, people continued to watch. And then he said that both Michael Weatherly and the showrunner, Glenn Gordon Caron, are receiving leadership coaching, which was mutually agreed upon by the producer and the network. And I'm relieved that they're all getting along so well.
Yeah, leadership coaching is code for they're getting sensitivity training, they're getting anti-harassment training, all the things that they probably should have had a long time ago. But, you know, it's interesting that Kelly Call would come out and say, basically, this guy and this show are popular, so we're going to deal with the behavior issues, because that is the exact thing that people have been criticizing about Hollywood for decades, that stars and powerful people can do whatever they want because the audience is there for them. And we've seen shifts in the past few years about tolerance of this kind of behavior. And for the head of a network to come right out and say, you know what, it's okay, he does well, he performs for us, that rub people the wrong way.
Yeah, you know, this is a tricky moment for CBS. First of all, CBS's job is to make money, which we all know. But they're also on the brink of a merger, we believe, with Viacom, which both companies controlled by Shari Redstone, certainly the most powerful woman in a job at that level. I mean, an owner-operator of a company, basically, of two companies, two big media giants. They're not as giant as they used to be, but they're going to merge. She's going to be looking. I mean, you know, so what do you do? Do you decide I'm going to go for the gold, or you decide this might hit her the wrong way because its behavior is bad? I mean, I'm not even saying it's a simple answer, but I think calling something leadership training when people have been accused of bad behavior, it doesn't sit that well with me.
Well, Shari Redstone cares about money just as much as the next owner, and this is a perilous time for broadcast television, so a hit is a hit. I'm not saying that they should cancel Bull because the star was accused of bad behavior, but it does seem like there is a way to handle this in a private and public way that would at least send the message that things are being done and a culture, the network is evolving.
Meanwhile, on a different show, which has nothing to do with CBS, we just saw Mario Lopez get himself into trouble for giving an interview in which he said some comments about how you can't let a three-year-old decide what their gender is. He was saying it's dangerous to let children do this, and this was taken badly by his employer even. They said it did not represent their views. I mean, it's a silly interview, but it comes as Extra has another problem, which was co-host A.J. Calloway. A.J. Calloway was suspended, and we have just reported that they have finally said that they have broken ties with him.
Yeah, this is an interesting one because the initial allegations against A.J. Calloway were years ago. I mean, he was arrested and ultimately the case was not prosecuted because of a procedural reason. But these allegations have bubbled up for a long time. And then in the Me Too era of the past couple of years, they have been outright in the media. You've reported it. A couple of other outlets have reported it. Finally, this past February, they suspended him after an additional story brought up new allegations of sexual assault. So, you know, now 7 months later, here we are where he has finally cut ties. It's unclear when this actually happened. But, you know, it just points to the slow nature of how these allegations are brought to companies and they either don't act right away or they take their time investigating this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that Salai Abrams, who brought us the story of her alleged sexual assault in 2006, which led to his arrest, we published that story. Other people came forward, including three rape allegations, a couple of police investigations in two states that I think at least one, probably both, are ongoing. So this was not just a thing that where you would say, oh, he spoke inappropriately. I mean, these allegations are extremely serious. And Salai Abrams kept on this in terms of demanding answers from Warners. What are you doing with this guy? Are you looking into this? And then this past week, she started tweeting. You know, John Stankey sat for a major interview in Variety, and she started tweeting. Well, he talked in this interview about how forthright and straightforward, and he cuts to the chase. And she's like, all right, fine. What's going on with A.J. Calloway? Which prompted within 2 hours or so, I think, a Warner Brothers attorney to call her attorney and say, okay, we've parted ways. Now, they said it was mutual consent, but I will tell you, we then got a statement confirming this. It was very terse. There was no, like, thank you for your service.
Yeah, this has been a statement likely sitting on some Warner Brothers publicist's computer for a while now, and they were just waiting for the moment. But it is embarrassing that the accuser has to tweet at the CEO of the company to get a lawyer to respond. Not a good look for the company, but, you know, this is where we are in the Me Too era.
Yeah, not just the CEO of the Warner Brothers, the CEO of Warner Media, John Stankey. I mean, she was aiming high. But I will say, Matt, I've done a number of these stories. You've been the editor on a number of these stories where it's contentious and a fight. And pretty much in every single case, the companies know. Amazon knew what we were alleging with Roy Price, the former head of their studio. Warner Brothers, again, and its parent company, knew about allegations involving the chairman of the studio, Kevin Sugihara, literally for more than a year. We serve it up. We say, this is what we're working on. This is what we're trying to confirm. They're gambling over and over again that we won't get into the end zone and publish. I can't understand the strategy. They know, in most of these cases, as much as we know, maybe more, probably more, and yet they kind of sit there to see if we're going to publish.
Yeah, I mean, this speaks to the role that the media is playing in the Me Too movement, which I believe is an important role. But in the Sugihara situation, that was an odd one because we had heard some rumblings that Sugihara, the CEO of the company, was not exactly forthright with his bosses about the extent of his relationship with this woman, Charlotte Kirk. And ultimately, it took us publishing the text exchanges to show what was actually going on here. And then they acted. But it does get to this question of, are these companies acting because they believe that it's the right thing to do, or are they doing it because they're being shamed by the media?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't mind seeing a shift from let's wait until we get caught to let's be a little bit more proactive about enforcing their actual codes of conduct. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you. And I am definitely Hobbs.
Well, we'll see about that. That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Lulu Wang's new movie, The Farewell, is as advertised on the screen before the story even begins, based on an actual lie. That lie is about what happened in real life when Wang's Chinese grandmother was diagnosed with late-stage lung cancer. In The Farewell, Awkwafina plays Billy, a version of Wang, who's shocked to learn that her parents, played by Tai Ma and Diana Lin, have no intention of telling her grandmother about the bleak diagnosis.
She doesn't have a lot of time left. She should know, right?
There's nothing they can do. So everyone decided it's better not to tell her.
Why is that better?
Chinese people have a saying. When people get cancer, they die.
It's not the cancer that kills them. It's the fear.
In a story that plays for laughs and for tears, the family heads to China using a hastily planned wedding for Billy's cousin as a reason for the visit. For the grandmother, Nai Nai, it will be a celebration, but for everyone else, it will be a chance to say goodbye. As The Farewell rolled out in theaters this summer, other independent films such as Booksmart and Late Night, which also had strong festival debuts, bombed at the box office. Your movie is the one this summer that has done a number, you know, per screen average number.
Yeah, it's wild. You know, I guess I try not to think about it because those are things that are outside of my control. But I'm observing it from the outside as well, because it's not always about the movie. Late Night is a great movie. Booksmart is a great movie. These are movies that people should have gone out to the theaters to see. And so instead of us blaming audiences and saying, you know, people don't go to the theater anymore and let's just put everything on streaming sites, when you have something that works, you kind of go, well, and this is, by the way, this is a movie that's 80% in Mandarin. It's 100% Asian cast. And, you know, we get the stats every morning. And we did a screening in Charlotte recently and we got the stats for it. And it was 60% African-American. And the response was excellent. And it just is amazing for me to watch from the outside because, you know, of course, when I made the film, I just made a very specific film that was very specific to my family and my experiences. And then you think, well, who's going to resonate with this? It's hard to know. Maybe people on the coasts, maybe San Francisco. There's a lot of Asian Americans, New York, Los Angeles. But as we go wider and we're going into middle America, we're going into communities with people of color, with older people, it's interesting to see, yeah, who resonates with it.
Let me step back to this issue of who is it for, of course, was the issue. It took you a long time to get this movie made.
Yeah, because people kept asking if it was going to be a Chinese film or an American film. And is it a comedy or a drama? You know, it's like these boxes.
Give me the box.
Yeah, give me the box. So, and what's the comp?
In other words, what is it like? What movie that worked? Yes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to my producer, Andrew Miano, yesterday, and, you know, he's watching the film as a case study. He's been a producer with Chris Weitz and Paul Weitz for many, many years, was involved with American Pie and all of this, and just watching it in a way as a phenomenon and saying, there are no comps, really. With a film like this, it becomes the comp.
Right.
And that's what's exciting.
It's supposed to be a bad thing that there are no comps. So maybe it's not actually a bad thing. Maybe it's a very, very good thing if it works, of course.
Right. If you're trying to do something new, you're trying to take risks, you're trying to change the system, you're trying to tell new stories that haven't been told, then yeah, there are no comps. And you hope to be the one to break that, right? And yet so few people are really willing to take those risks.
Mm. So you did initially think of this as a film.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And no takers.
No. I mean, I can't say that I'm surprised because it's my second film. My first film didn't go very wide. It had a very, very small release. So, you know, I walk into a room and I'm like, I want to make a film. It's about my Chinese grandmother. I want to make it as an American film, American financed, American perspective. But the entire cast is Chinese, Chinese-American. And this was before Crazy Rich Asians.
Major point, yeah.
Right, exactly. And on top of that, they're all going to be speaking in their authentic languages, which means, you know, with an accent while speaking English or completely in Chinese.
I'm trying to imagine the dumbfounded silence that you got in some meetings, probably.
Yeah. And then they're like, well, are we saving her life or what is it about? What are the stakes? Does someone die? Does someone overcome something big? And you're like, no, it's actually just about how do we grieve? Hard pitch.
Somebody, I think an American finance, they were like, can it be like my big fat Chinese wedding? Is that a real thing that happened?
Yes. Yes.
That makes me sad. I mean, it's just very predictable.
Yeah. I mean, it's sad. And I guess that's the only comp for them, right? What's an ethnic movie that made a lot of money that also deals with a wedding.
Yes. So they're looking for that. And you talked to a Chinese financier who wanted you to put a white guy in the movie?
Yeah, because he saw this also from a very westernized lens, you know, that if it involves a woman who looks Chinese but has grown up in America, you know, the version of that story that they've seen before is the funny white guy that she brings home to the family.
Oh, I see.
You know what I mean? And that's a popular storyline in China because everybody loves to laugh at the Lao Bai. Lao Bai is like in Chinese what you say for like the old foreigner. Which is kind of a slightly derogatory term for foreigner,
that,
right?
Yeah.
You know, but they love to laugh at that guy because he doesn't understand the culture.
I mean, we totally have a counterpart to funny old China. I mean, Bonanza.
Right.
Going back to my early childhood watching reruns.
Exactly.
That character.
Yeah, it's sort of the comedic relief, right? Like the foreigner that doesn't know how to use chopsticks and keeps messing up. And, you know, or now they have the other version, which is the white guy that knows Chinese better than the Chinese-American that goes back to China. And so there's all of these sort of stereotypes and cliches that continue to get rehashed. And in many ways, you know, that financier from China also saw it through this lens. But the bigger issue was that he said, if it's for a Chinese audience, the story cannot be told through Billy, who's the main character that's loosely based on me and my experience, can't be told through her eyes because your perspective is too American for a Chinese audience to resonate with.
Oh, boy.
And so I said, how do we tell the story? Who's the main character? He's like, well, we create a Chinese character who completely understands, and he's the main character, and maybe Billy is the side character, and ultimately she comes to learn the Chinese ways and embrace all of it.
Okay.
It's like, yeah, I don't know how to tell that story.
Right. So that wasn't working. And then you do this piece for This American Life, which I'm actually, tell us how that came to be.
Well, I was on the festival circuit with a short film that I had made called Touch, and Neil Drumming is a producer at This American Life. At the time, he was just starting on the show, and he has a background as a journalist, but also as a filmmaker. And so he was at the film festival, saw my short film, and said, you know, I really like your voice. And I think that he saw his role as a storyteller, but also just on This American Life to bring more diversity to This American Life. So he just asked this very general question of what are the stories that you want to tell? And said, funny you should ask. I have this story about my grandmother that I wanted to make into a film, but I didn't and I couldn't. So here it is. It all happened very, very quickly.
I almost have to believe it. When he first said that to you, there was a voice in your head saying, this is such a dream question and it's not going to turn into a thing because I've been turned down a lot.
Yeah. You know, when he asked me that, first of all, I'm a huge fan of of the show. So it was a dream to be able to do it. But even my agent at the time didn't necessarily see that as a stepping stone to movies. He thought, oh, great. Well, it'll help you pay your bills. By the way, it's very sad when public radio is the way that
you can
pay your bills.
You're not paying much of a bill with that one.
Exactly. Okay. But that was more than, you know, anything else I was doing at the time. So it was almost like a side project. But going through the experience of telling that story was life-changing for me because the process was unlike anything that I had ever experienced before. It was very emotional. It reminded me of why I became a storyteller in the first place. Mm. I went to dinner with one of my best friends the night that the story aired, and I started crying at the bar.
Aww.
And he's like, but this is great. Like, you know, you love the show. It's out. You get to tell your story. And I said, yeah, but, you know, this experience was so pure that it made me realize that I'm never going to have this experience again as a filmmaker because I can't have my voice in Hollywood. And I think that I picked the wrong medium to be a storyteller because for the last 10 years, I've just been trying to get my films made and completely forgot about why I became a storyteller in the first place, or even like forgot about how to find a process that feels really good and authentic to me.
And how quickly does the next thing happen?
Well, after the story aired, within 24 to 48 hours, I got emails and phone calls. The first one being Chris White, who tweeted at me, and he sent me a tweet and said, I sent you a DM, not sure if you checked them. I also emailed you via your website, not sure if that's the right way. Anyways, And of course, I did get the email and it was like, hi, I'm Chris. My brother and I are producers. We really like movies. It was like the sweetest, most earnest thing.
Unpretentious.
Unpretentious thing from a guy that wrote, you know, Star Wars. And so, of course, you know, we had lunch and he said, I love this story so much and I just want to work with you to bring it to the screen and also just to protect your vision. Because so often with independent films, personal stories, a lot of cooks come into the kitchen and it does get diluted. And he said, I've seen that happen and I think that I can be of service in making sure that I help fight for your voice throughout this whole process. And I really appreciated that and said, absolutely, let's work together. And a week later, Big Beach came on board wanting to produce and ultimately finance the film. And luckily, Chris didn't really have to protect me because we had this great company in Big Beach who saw filmmaking in the same way.
And I mean, how did they know that it was a thing at that point? Do you know?
Peter Saraf also heard the story.
Ah, so he was
on This
there
American
too.
Life. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then he reached out and I said, well, we already have Chris. Let's all work together.
Coming up after a short break, Lulu Wong tells us about the vagaries of figuring out how to shoot in China. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to writer and director Lulu Wong about her new film, The Farewell, which is now in theaters. The Farewell is based on real events in Wong's life. Her family emigrated from China when she was a small child, but returned for a particularly fraught visit when her grandmother, Nai Nai, was diagnosed with cancer and given only months to live. Everyone knew Nai Nai was sick, except Nai Nai. The family decided not to tell her, so the excuse for the visit was a relative's hastily arranged and rather comedic wedding. Initially, Billy's family doesn't want her to come on the trip. They're certain she won't be able to hide her emotions. This leads to arguments between Billy and her mom, played by Diana Lynn.
She's dying. Can you be a little more sensitive?
What do you want from me? To scream and cry like you?
The role of Billy in The Farewell is a departure for Awkwafina, who's known for rapping and for her over-the-top role in Crazy Rich Asians. So it's no surprise that Wong had her doubts at first.
My producer is the one who brought up her name, and I would never have thought of her for this role because...
At that point, you knew who she was?
Well, I knew her as a rapper.
Right.
You know, and so I said to my producer, wait, the girl from Queens that did My Vag? She did Green Tea with Margaret Cho, right? Like, that's who you want to play...
Me?
Me? Are we making the same film here? And we met for coffee, though, and she just told me about how personal the script was to her because she was raised by her own Chinese grandmother. And after that, she sent in a self-taped audition and blew me away, you know, because she's not a trained actor. And so you could tell there was something really raw about her performance and very real. And she was funny in very subtle ways, you know.
She knew not to overdo, even though she's such a big personality.
Exactly. And that's what was so wonderful to watch, too, is somebody who does have such a big personality to have to suppress it and the discomfort in not knowing who to be because you can't be yourself and you can't say the things that you might want to say.
Yes. So obviously you want to shoot in China. Mm-hmm. And what do you have to do?
We decided pretty early on that we really wanted to be a co-production, and we thought that we could because, you know, for obvious reasons.
You have the elements.
Yeah. You know, and obviously censorship and all that, and there's a lot of steps to getting there. And we said, well, let's just try our best. If it forces us to compromise the film too much, then we won't do it. Ultimately, we still want to primarily target this as an American film. But we set out to get what they call the dragon seal, which says that you're officially a co-production so that you don't have to be in that pool.
Right, you're not in the quota of system.
Exactly.
Your film gets to play in China without having to be lucky.
Exactly. And not just lucky, but like they tend to take the big blockbusters, you know. Yeah. And I think that I believe, don't quote me on this, but I've been told that we're the first independent film in America to have the co-production status.
Mm. Interesting. I mean, so then once your co-production shooting in China is just easy, not easy?
It's definitely challenging.
I'm not saying anything's easy, but you know what I mean.
It's very different. We didn't get our co-production status till after the shoot. We were hoping to get it before, and so there is a bit of a gamble there. And everything's touch and go because, you know, there's not one set way. Like at first we heard you have to have the status before you start shooting. Then they're like, well, sometimes you can get away with not having it and getting it after. And
I've heard from many, many Americans who tried to shoot in China. It's not like a simple like step one, step two, step three. You just try to figure out how.
Yeah. I think it helped, too, that my family is from that city and lives there. And maybe that helped. I'm not sure. But there was just a lot for my producers to navigate.
So you get the film done and you go to Sundance. There's that bidding war.
Mm.
You get an offer from Netflix, but...
Unnamed streaming service.
Okay, you get an offer. Sorry, unnamed streaming service. But you don't want a streaming service.
Right.
And so A24.
A24, yeah.
Did you sit up all night and like entertain the offers?
Oh, yeah. It was exactly what you've heard myths about, right?
Yes. The,
of like getting in a car late at night and being driven to a house.
A condo somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And people come in. And but yeah, you know, it was also serendipitous the way that it all happened, because I do think that if the streaming service came in very early with very, very high numbers, there was no way that I could have convinced my producers, investors to leave that much money on the table. But because A24 was the winning bid, you know, Friday we premiered, so they were kind of bidding between Friday, Saturday. It wasn't until Sunday that this other streaming service came in and just wanted to disrupt the whole negotiation and doubled the offer. That at that point, you know, I said, we already made the decision. We gave them our word. We're in exclusive conversation with them already. I came into this festival knowing that these were going to be the people for me, if we were lucky enough that they would be one of the bidders. And this is what I want. And I don't want to live in a world where the person with the biggest wallet gets to throw money and win. And, you know, we've heard everybody's pitch, and I like A24's pitch. I think that they're going to love the movie the way that it needs to be loved. And, you know, I had to give this very impassioned speech in order to...
Yes, unclench your fist from that money. I'm amazed that must have taken some doing because, you know, Hollywood money.
But I had great producers. You know, I think that they have values. And that's why they supported this film from the beginning. They resonated with the core, the heart of the emotions of the story.
I mean, you know, the other side of that coin, when we've had certain people on, maybe Ava DuVernay has said this, that more eyeballs will be on the movie if it streams in the end. But I suppose there's no reason why it won't end up on a streaming platform after it has theatrical release anyway.
Exactly. It'll get there. And, you know, seeing young Chinese Americans who maybe never had these difficult conversations with their families, bringing their parents, bringing their grandparents to the movies, having this communal shared experience, it's church. You know, there's something spiritual about that. And one of my best friends from college, her grandmother's 99 years old, Italian, has not been to the movies in 70 years.
Oh my God.
And came out with her granddaughter to see the movie and cried.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it's hard to quantify that financially, that kind of value, but we need spaces, we need community.
Lulu Wang is the writer and director of The Farewell. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.